I can't see. Thumbs up?
Thumbs up.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. I asked the same question in our last session. Who's a big winner in Vegas so far? Okay, we
got a couple. Right on.
We didn't have any in our last session, so we're off to a good start. Who's the big loser so far? Just one?
All right. Needs a t-shirt.
That's good. That's right. I think you need some swag then, since you haven't won anything yet, so you can win some swag, no? All right. Well, we're going to get going in just a few minutes here, but before we get started, we've got some swag here to give out. Who's got a little kid who would love to play with this hacky sack? All right. This hand was first, so that's two for the middle section. Now we're going left side. Show me you want it. Come on. There you go. There we go. Very good. Did the right get any yet?
I got to get it in the back.
You got the one back there?
Get as far back as you can.
All right, in the whole place, who wants this gorgeous, lovely office orange and white hacky sack the most? Come on, show me you want it. Show me some love. Gentlemen back there in the vest, I'm going to try to bomb this. All right, you ready?
Yeah.
All right. All right. Thank you. Just call the Yankees. Tell them I'm available. All right. Now, these are not going to go that far. So you're probably first 10 rows. I'm going to do my best. Got some t-shirts now here. Oh, that one faded out. Give it a shot. All right, left side now. I'm just going to throw it in general here. Oh, it's still folded when you caught it. Nice.
That's as far as they're going to go.
I like that. Well, all right, we'll go to the bowling. There we go. All right, one more for you here, Mike.
That's all right. Go ahead.
All right. Show me some love for this one. All right. I see a lot in the middle. Here we go. Oh, it's caught in the chandelier. All right. Everyone needs a little energy, right, at this time of the third day in Vegas in the afternoon, get a little tired and whatnot. I'll try to keep the energy level up in here today. I'll teach you a lot of good stuff about building internet sites with SharePoint. Before we really kick it off, I'm curious, who has built an internet site on Public Office 365 before? More than I thought so far. Awesome. It's a new product, you know, so I didn't think many people had done that. Who's planning on doing it? Wow, look at that, almost a third. And what about on-prem? Who's looking for the on-premises solution? Definitely the most in the crowd there, okay. Well, that gives us a little level set on what you're all looking to do, and we can kind of tailor our content that way. I guess we'll get started now. My name is Todd Baginski. I work at Canvas Consulting, where I lead our mobility and SharePoint solutions divisions, and I've been doing SharePoint for 10, 11 years. I think I've lost count at this point now. Eight-time Microsoft SharePoint MVP, but I'd trade that in for a heartbeat, actually, if I could make a living being a ski controller or a ski instructor instead, actually. You got any skiers in the house? All right, all right.
I'm Michael Sherman, also work at Canvas. I'm a solution architect focusing on SharePoint and web solutions. Also been doing SharePoint for the better part of 10 years, primarily dev background, but also had the chance to branch out into some ops and now architecture work. Put 20 years of hard time into being a Seahawks fan, and it's finally paid off, so go Hawks, yeah. All right. And if you were at the dev keynote, you know that you cannot have a legitimate dev session without a guy with a beard, so even though you've got an eight-time MVP, I'm the beard here. So
we got you covered. Okay, who hasn't seen this slide yet? All right, this slide here is all about the Office 365 platform. As you know, you can make the great new contextual apps, a lot of new robust APIs there, flexible tooling. Our last session we did this morning was all about building cloud-hosted apps on Office 365. It touched on a lot of this. Really, today we're just talking about the Office 365 aspect of a public website, so that'll be the main focus related to that slide in our presentation.
So what are we going to do today? We're going to go over some just the capabilities that are in SharePoint and Office 365 for building internet sites and what we mean by that. We're going to look at some examples of some on-prem sites that use some of those advanced capabilities. We're going to talk quite a bit about mobile. I mean, I'm sure that it's, you know, all of us that are thinking about building sites, especially for internet audiences. Mobile's a huge topic right now. We're going to go over what we can do with the public websites available in Office 365, and we're going to look at a website that we built for Microsoft on top of that platform. We're going to wrap up and draw some conclusions.
Quick poll. Everyone's in here because they want to build an internet site on SharePoint. Who does not have a requirement to support mobile devices on your site? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, maybe there's 200 or 300 people in here. Okay, so it's less than 1%. So that's reality now. I've been doing sessions on internet sites with SharePoint for quite a long time, and just 2 years ago, you would get 5 people who said, I do have to do that requirement, and now as we've seen, it's pervasive. It's part of what we do. So that's why we're going to spend some time showing you demos and other things about what you can do with mobile to make your life easy as a content author, as well as the different approaches you can take and how you choose one versus the other. So we're going to get started here and just talk about SharePoint in general. What capabilities does this have? Does this give us to build an internet site? Before we do that, Mike's going to help us draw the line.
So when we talk about an internet-facing site, what do we mean? Well, we're still talking about SharePoint, all the things we do in SharePoint generally. But, you know, we usually aren't going to use all of the facets of SharePoint. There's a lot of things in the product that are really collaboration-focused, really, you know, intranet-focused. There are some capabilities, however, that are specific to internet use cases, and we'll go over some of those. And there's even more that are used in both places but actually need to be used a little bit differently in the internet context. Just basically, you know, what are we talking about with internet sites? Things that we're communicating with audiences that are outside of our organizations, primarily marketing-related activities. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about, you know, consuming capabilities differently, when we're talking about internet requirements and scale, we really have to think a lot about those things. You know, robustness of our solutions, and that we don't know who our users are. We don't know what their intent is. They could be trying to do something malicious. Performance, you know, when we're trying to estimate our audience size, you know, maybe we get picked up in the news on social media somewhere and our traffic goes through the roof. And then security, like I mentioned, you know, dealing with anonymous users.
So what we want to point out is that, you know, the points Mike's making is SharePoint's this big, right? And how much of it do you usually use to make an internet site? Well, maybe about this much of the whole platform. So we're not talking about every single aspect in SharePoint today. We're having a very focused discussion on here are what are the things inside of the SharePoint platform that you will typically use to build an internet site. These are those topics: WCM, branding, nav, search, localization. Who has to build a website that works in one more than one locale? A lot.
Majority, yep.
A lot, yeah. We're working on a site right now. It's a huge global site. It has 150 different locales it targets. So it's real world. It's how it works. And we're going to talk about which capabilities you can use there. And then, of course, as we said, mobile. So at the end of the day, it's really all about your content on an internet site, right? I mean, you're not trying to build a line of business app usually or drive a business process. You're trying to get information out to people. You're trying to sell something or you're trying to support your customers. How do you do that and get that content out there? Well, SharePoint, as you probably know, comes with some great publishing features. It's improved and really better than ever in SharePoint 2013. So you're going to have the foundational aspect of your SharePoint site by really leveraging those publishing features. Then enter SharePoint 2013. Now we have cross-site publishing, which allows us to take information in one site collection and view it and render it on another. If you've architected a SharePoint site before, especially for those of you who are doing multilingual things, you'll know that being able to share information from one site collection into another can be a really big advantage for you. There is an awesome session that was delivered last year at the SharePoint conference. And that session is all about variations, cross-site publishing, and Josh Stickler is a gentleman who co-presented it. We don't have time to dig into how to do that in specific. It does take a whole session to talk about. You'll find in the session notes a link to that, and it'll teach you about all these things regarding how to move your content and share it in different parts of your internet site with catalogs, items. It talks about a single environment where content authors and the rendering process occurs, or if you want to distribute that. Maybe this side of the room is my content authors, and the rest of you are just going to view the content. I could make an environment so they could just log into it and edit content. I could make another environment that just renders it to you. Josh breaks all that down in a session, and I really strongly recommend you read that before you embark on making a site that does things like variations and multilingual capabilities. We also have this new thing called the Content by Search Web Part. This is the Content by Query Web Part's big brother. He's new and improved. He can still work the same way that you could with the Content by Query Web Part to take information out of lists and libraries in SharePoint and render it on your pages. And he now also works with the cross-site publishing as well. So again, check out that presentation from last year because it's really core knowledge for all things related to content and variations in your SharePoint sites.
Similarly, we're not going to have time to get real deep into this design manager topic. There's lots of good content out there specifically to it already as well. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to mention that it's new and it's really useful, especially we like the snippet gallery and the snippet functionality in the design manager to enable you to have developers that don't really know or want to write ASP.NET code easily work on your publishing assets. Less code required, easier code, less specialized SharePoint stuff that you have to worry about. The packaging feature is great for deploying things into the composed looks gallery so they can easily be selectable by site owners between themes. In areas where we don't necessarily have the packages available, we can automate deployment of some of these with the client-side object model, which we'll touch on a little bit later in the session.
Yeah, we've got a cool demo that can really show you how to take advantage of things you've made from the design manager and push them out to your Office 365 public site with a single click of a button. What about Nav? Well, there's a lot of things you can do with Nav and SharePoint. And again, this is one of those things that if you tried to dive all the way in on what can you do with Nav and SharePoint, then we wouldn't have a chance to really give you the all up on the differences between on-prem and an Office 365 site and do some good demos for you. But at a whole part, you need to keep these things in mind. You can use the classic Nav that SharePoint has nowadays. And that's the one that's really more structurally oriented. You look at the URLs and they map up to where your site and your page structure is in there. But now you have the managed navigation. Managed navigation essentially means that you're storing the links in your nav and in your menus inside of the term store with SharePoint. And then you can use the out-of-the-box controls that SharePoint comes with and hook them up to that managed navigation so you can manage it in one spot very easily. Or you can write your own controls, and you can call into the term store via the different APIs in SharePoint, getting back to that rich API slide we talked about before, to roll your own. We're going to show you an example of a custom nav control we made to accommodate mobile users for iPads and iPhones as well. What's the best part about that?
Friendly URLs is my favorite thing ever.
Yeah.
It's been a challenge with SharePoint in the past. Marketing people don't like /pages/whatever.aspx. It really had to follow our structure. We ended up creating a lot of subsites to support that we may have not really wanted. Mm-hmm. If we use the friendly URL features, it's decoupled from the structure. Again, we can easily assign URLs, multiple URLs, in pretty cool ways to do tag-based navigation and some more advanced things.
So those friendly URLs, now that they're capable, is not going to make your life really difficult to try to write some kind of special HTTP module and intercept a request and rewrite the URL so it's pretty in the browser. So it's just a matter of configuring things now. We really point this out because we have seen websites that we were going to build before not use SharePoint because of the complexity involved with implementing a friendly URL. So now you don't have to worry about that. If you've heard about that in the past, it's easy to do.
So we mentioned security a little bit. So yeah, we're dealing with anonymous users. Again, we don't know who our users are necessarily. We need to protect ourselves against anyone who might be malicious. So obviously, the first thing we have to worry about is just web app and site permissions to ensure that we ensure that we're only opening things up to anonymous users that they should see. So one thing they pretty much always shouldn't see is our list and library forms and the details of some of those list items. This feature is not a new thing, but we did want to point it out. It's now visible in the UI. It was a PowerShell thing before to lock down those form pages and require permissions to be able to see those things, to limit, you know, information disclosure vulnerabilities, things like that. So, okay, I secure my site properly, and then I turn that on, and I'm done, right? Mm-hmm. Well, not so much. If I'm going to use the client-side object model or the REST API to do things, there's a permission called use remote interfaces, and there's some other settings I can set in the client callable settings array for my web app that kind of control what things are available via the client-side object model. The danger here is that as soon as I turn that on for anonymous users, I've undone the good things I did by turning the view form lockdown feature on. So anyone who might know how to use that REST API can start querying my site for things, and I may be returning things that I don't want to see, such as, you know, my usernames of my internal users who may have been editing things. So we really need to be careful about only understanding what content's out there and the ways people can access it, and being very careful about that. And lastly, just a quick note that we're not talking about necessarily full trust solutions and run with scissors. It's people's funny name for run with elevated privileges, but be even more careful than you otherwise would if you're doing those kind of things in a public-facing site.
So, you've got your site all locked down. You're doing good practices to make sure that your users can't get to your content. And then enter search. Search can kind of undo a few things on you if you're not careful. Or it can actually block your content from being rendered inside of a content by search web part unless you take care on how you set up your crawls. Now, we ran into this one firsthand with one of our clients where we built an internet site for them on 2013. It had several content by search web parts inside of it. Those content by search web parts get their content because the search service indexes the content in your SharePoint lists. After it's been indexed, then the content by search web part can go against that index and pull the information out and render it on the page. When they went to deploy it, what they did was they did not crawl it as an anonymous user. They crawled it as an authenticated user, and they had view form pages lockdown turned on. Well, that meant when the view form pages lockdown is turned on, that anonymous users do not have permission to see the list items there. So what that meant is after they did the crawl and then went to the home page of their portal and look at the hero graphic that's supposed to be a content by search web part, there's no content in it. Why? Well, because you told SharePoint by turning the lockdown on that anonymous users aren't allowed to see the content. Then you crawled it with an authenticated account so you didn't get any errors during your crawl. And the only time you could see the content is if you're logged into the site. You may be scratching your head when that occurs, like, I just don't understand why my content's not here right now. So to make sure you don't hit situations like that, set up different zones in your SharePoint site, one that you use for crawling, one that you use to render your content to anonymous users. This way, your permissions will all line up all the time, your content will be viewable by all your users, and you won't open the door accidentally to let anonymous users see content that you have secured in your list and libraries that's not meant for anonymous users. So as you can see, two whole slides on security. There's a ton to talk about here. Again, it's a very broad topic. Kirk Evans has a blog post. He works in the Center of Excellence for Microsoft with Azure. And he has a blog post, what every developer should know about SharePoint security. We have a link to it in our references section. It's another must read again before you go do an internet site with SharePoint to understand how all these things work at a really deep level. And that brings us to mobile. So everybody but five people in here is interested in this topic. There's a couple different ways you can go about making your SharePoint site mobile. And we're going to show you a demo of both of them. The first one is to use Responsive Web Design, or RWD. And I know you've probably already been to a session on that this week because there's been a few of them out there, so I'm not going to get into really how to make RWD. The other thing is device channels in SharePoint. Device channels allow you to target specific devices that make requests to your SharePoint site and then serve content just to that device. You can make your own device channels in an on-premise SharePoint installation. You can make up to 10 per site collection and include up to 150 devices inside of each channel that you create. And in general, when you're doing mobile, it goes without saying, use general mobile best practices for all the things we've listed here. You'll notice the last thing you see on the screen is a link. It's also in the slide deck resources section. I created an application if you're doing SharePoint apps, or even if you're not, but it has a pattern in it, and there's a blog article I wrote on it which walks you through how you can use free tools from Microsoft to automatically minify your JavaScript and your CSS as soon as you build your solution every single time. And that is a really good practice to get into so that you can develop against one set of files that are easy to look at, and then when you build it, now you have the minified set of files which go out to production.
So we have all these, both of these techniques available. How do we choose what to use and when and how? So there are some challenges with responsive web design. I don't want to be negative. We love RWD. We do it on almost all of our web projects now. There's great components in there. I especially like the thinking in terms of grids, mm-hmm. and also thinking in terms of what certain viewport sizes do as opposed to general device capabilities. Mm-hmm. I think those are great things RWD brings. It's a great kind of pure CSS solution. Some things we've found over the last year we've been doing these kind of things a lot is there are content managers out there that want more control over their different experiences. Mm-hmm. RWD is a lot about kind of scaling and responding your designs to fit more, different viewport sizes, but there's some content managers that really want to target things at mobile. In our experience, there's a lot of kind of hacky ways to do that in RWD, but no real, clean solutions. Full page payloads are always or usually delivered, right? I'm sending all my HTML down, and I'm messing with my CSS to be responsive. So if we're really concerned about performance, especially on slow or mobile connections, that can be an issue. We've seen a whole bunch, and I think a lot of you probably have too, reinvent the wheel component implementations trying to be responsive. Component one on my page that I got from this library might think I'm one kind of browser. Component two might think I'm another because their authors have just had to build some of this stuff from scratch, mm-hmm. and that can be difficult to work with. There's something we wanted to point out on that really large 150 locale huge site that Todd mentioned. We did some math on what we were spending our time on as far as front-end dev work, and we actually came up with an observation that up to 25% of that time was spent dealing with enabling RWD and making it work across all the devices. And some of the reason for that is, you might tweak one sort of experience and then cause a lot of regressions throughout all the other ones that really have to be dealt with. Also image renditions, which we mentioned a little bit. The integration is pretty complicated, and we'll show you a little bit about how we did that, but it's can be kind of a challenge sometimes.
Yeah, the image rendition capability of SharePoint, which allows you to send a rendition of an image and to fit a smaller viewport. And just, responsive design, if I have an image, let's just say my page is this wide, my image is this wide at the top of the page in the desktop. Let's say it's a 100K image. Well, now I need a responsive design, and I want to show this same image on your phone, so it needs to be this big instead. Well, with a responsive design, and if you don't use image renditions, then what you're going to get is still a 100K image that's now been scaled down to this size. Who wants to deliver a 100K image that shows up as an inch by an inch, right? You're just costing your users time on load and giving them a bad mobile experience. If you use image renditions, you upload the file to SharePoint and you say, I'm going to use the big image rendition in the desktop, it's 100K. And when I request the image rendition for the mobile channel or within, if you write extra code to integrate it with a responsive design, I can trim that image down to maybe 5K. And so that's huge differences, especially if your website has a lot of images or more marketing hype and things like that that are very visual.
So inter-device channels. Now, what those can give us is a more, you know, very easy to add, configure, and content manage. We have the device channel panel control. We can just very easily add to a layout and say this content's targeted here, this content's targeted there. That helps with our content management issue that we were talking about. There's a little bit of a gotcha that we just came across in a recent project. You can't add a web part zone at the moment to a device channel panel. There's a couple of workarounds for that. Mm-hmm. If your HTML size isn't super important, we can actually just add the web parts to a rich content field. And those can be inside device channel panels. Or one we found that we like a little better is there's both client and server-side ways to actually have your controls understand which device channel they're in and respond appropriately. The effective device channel variable in JavaScript, for instance. Device channels give us better and more fine control over browser detection. If we really know we want to do something with iPhone 7 user or iOS 7 users, we can target that by creating a device channel for that. And configuring our content appropriately. We can decide to deliver completely different page payloads if we want to. We can assign separate master pages to device channels, or we can share if we're doing, you know, more smaller differences between those. As contrasting to RWD and image renditions and device channels were built to work together, extremely easy to integrate them. Also, we really find that oftentimes hybrid approaches here work great. I don't have to pick one or the other. And when we were kind of working on this deck, some words we kept finding when looking at what people were saying about RWD and mobile was, you got to think about progressive enhancement or graceful degradation. So there's a few ways to think about it. And one way is, you know, progressive enhancement. I'm going to design my base website for the least capable device that I'm going to encounter. And then I'm going to build from there. As I get larger screens, more real estate, more capabilities, I'm going to have my site respond and add those things. Or the other way to think about it, I'm going to design my site for the most capable thing. And then I need to think about how, as my browsers get smaller and less capable, I kind of change and respond and remove things to make those work right.
And another way to look at that same thing, and the reason we're spending so much time talking about RWD versus device channels is this is a big deal. If you don't really think through which one of these approaches you want to use up front and map it to what your site and your content looks like, you may end up with an implementation that's very hard to maintain. Like we mentioned, 25% of dev time on a certain site is being spent on just making it look perfect in like 8 different viewports on our responsive design. Who wants to spend 25% of the time you have developing CSS just to get spacing perfect on every single device, and new ones come out all the time? It's not a real good time way to spend your time. Another way to look at progressive enhancement versus graceful degradation is, if I'm using device channels, I can look at my traffic and say, okay, I'm looking at my overall traffic for usage on my site. Look at these 5 devices. They make up 94%, let's say, of the traffic that comes to my website. Therefore, I'm going to make 5 device channels to target 94% of my users and give them a perfect user experience with the minimal amount of information needed to be downloaded and a very simple pattern to implement image renditions that I talked about to make things load very quickly. Then I can progressively enhance that to go after all these other devices that make up my 6% of users. And I can go add a channel for maybe this device over here does 2 of that 6%. Okay, I'll spend a day, make a new device channel, change the HTML and CSS for that, bang, it's ready to go. On the other hand, if you're using responsive design, you try to target it for those 5 things at 94%, and now it's time to do the other 6%. And what do? I try to get these other 6% to work, and I start to find out that they start breaking the original 94% that I did. And that's where that churn comes in, and now you've got tons of dev time just making your site perfect. And you, in a large dev team with a ton of different developers, if they're not all intimately familiar with the style guide, with presentation standards, with how to use divs, which classes to use, you start getting duplicated classes for CSS, you start getting misuse of certain classes. let's be honest, we're human. That's how development works, right? So those are really big things to think about, how much time you want to manage that in your environment and keeping it perfect in RWD versus a device channel approach. There is one thing to mention. There's tons of blog articles on how to do RWD out there, and you can learn quickly. There's only a few on device channels. So you have a little bit more ramp up ahead of time, but it's not, as you'll see in the demo here, a complicated pattern. We recommend taking the time to learn it up front, and you'll get a lot of benefits in the long run from it. So the other thing most of the people in here said they were interested in was variations. Again, I've got it here more as a reference point, and I'm not going to talk deep on it because SharePoint is capable of it. A couple things that are very good to point out, though. Now you can go to a SharePoint list or a Pages library, and you can pick a button in the ribbon to export it to the XLIF file format. You can hand that right off to your loc team. They'll go and loc it, give it back to you in XLIF, go right into SharePoint, upload the file, bingo, you're translated. Before, I don't know how you went about doing it, but we wrote things to extract the information and to put it into an XML or an XLIF format, and now you don't have to write a tool like that or maintain that kind of capability. Now we can also do lists with variations. Who's got a Pages library with like 20 different folders in it and a total of maybe 4,000 pages? Anybody got one like that? Well, on the site we're working on, we do. And the reason is because as you have to go and use variations and the limitations to content deployment to go to all the different bases to support so many site collections, the only way to do variations to move the content was Pages in SharePoint 2010. So we're really excited about as we migrate this thing to 2013, now we can take all those Pages libraries and we can put them in lists. And we don't have to create a content type based on the publishing page layout and have people edit pages every time to make content. At the end of the day, because we have this support for content in lists, more variation sites capable per base site, we can get rid of content deployment. A little hand for that one, right? If anybody's used that, you know that's a quirky part of SharePoint 2010, and you no longer need that. So that's really what I wanted to build up to that in this slide is go, hey, look forward to it, but think a lot about it because your architecture on how you replicate your content now and how you organize your content in your SharePoint sites is going to change. And again, Josh's presentation from last year walks you through all the different approaches you can use here. So now we've kind of really talked about all the pieces of SharePoint, what things you need to learn about, what you need to be aware of to build an internet site on SharePoint. We're going to start with some demos of an on-prem, a couple different on-prem SharePoint sites and illustrate some things, because this is a dev session, right? Anybody want to see some code? All right. So we're really not going to try to do because of the amount of time we have, like super deep dives on things. This is more of, we've done a lot of this stuff, so we're going to show you some neat little tips and tricks and patterns that we have figured out that if you follow them, it'll really make lives for you as a developer and your content authors much easier. So I'm going to start with an example of a responsive design website. So this is our new website, and we just launched this last week because we knew we wanted to demo it for the conference. And so we're working out a couple kinks with it still, but it's, for the most part, it's pretty good. It's built on SharePoint 2013. It uses a responsive design. So as you've seen these kind of demos before, make the screen smaller. Oh, look, the menu changed. Now I've got a different menu to fit a tablet size. And now I can get even smaller, and look, now it stacks vertically and looks really good in a phone, right? So that's a responsive design approach we took here. The reason we went responsive and not device channels, even though I was just saying device channels is so great, it's not always the best fit. You just have to look at your site and what you've got going on. We've got like 10, 12 pages in our site. It's pretty simple. We're a small company. You know, we do SharePoint services. We don't have to have support manuals and a million pages and sell tons of products. So doing responsive design for us was easy and a good choice because we have a limited amount of widgets, if you will, on our pages that need to respond to it. It was built by just a couple developers. So we don't have that huge dev team to manage and try to make sure our CSS and how we build things is always very consistent across a large group of people. But one thing that we found is as we're doing content authoring, for example, if I pull the page up here in my Windows Phone emulator, you can see there I've got the size of the phone that I like. But as a content author, if I pop this page in edit mode, how do I know if my content is going to fit there? So what we have done is you can see I popped the page in edit mode here, and everything is nice and responsive, and you know it builds and fits into the right spot, and I can come in directly here and edit my content. But how am I sure if I edit this content it's going to look right in this Windows Phone? Well, here's a little dev trick we've done to really help that. See my query string argument? Just question mark with. We just added that there, so we could use it during content authoring time. You can stick that in, go to the page, pop in an edit mode, and see it tells me how wide it is. So I can get a really good exact idea, actually, how my content is going to line up at authoring time. Oh, look, this phone is 320 pixels wide. I probably wouldn't have the emulator on my here if I was a content author, would I, and look that up. But I could be given a specification that says, here is your smallest viewport, make sure your content looks good in it. Then my author could turn that on and come over here and dial it in right to 320. And now they've got what you see is what you get on how they edit their content. And there's no guessing if you got it right. So just one of those little tricks you can do to make your content authors' lives easier and reduce the amount of times that a page gets published over and over and that, hey guys, you published a page and this is wrapping and covering the image and we found out in my iPhone now. You can really eliminate a lot of that by taking this approach. We're going to take this little code snippet we have here, put it in a little file and give it to you in the Yammer group associated with this particular session afterward. In fact, all the code that we're going to show is either in a blog post that we've already did, or it's going to be available for you in the Yammer site. So let's jump over to a site we've done with device channels and talk about a lot of tweaks you can do here. There's a lot more with device channels to learn. As I mentioned, there's not a lot of content out there on the internet that talks about how to use these. This is another site that actually is the same code base we used for a client site we built for a customer. We just swapped out the colors and the content with our imagery, given their permission, so that we could show it in demos. So here we are in the default device channel for our SharePoint site. And due to the widescreen nature of this and the resolutions I have available, I do have to scroll a little bit. But you can see, you got your typical website, the stuff at the bottom, the header, the footer, the hero control graphic, and a menu. Well, I've defined three device channels, and this was the progressive enhancement approach we used on this site because our client actually had 98% of their users used the devices you see right here. They used iPad 2 Plus, iPhone 4 Plus, or a desktop web browser. And so they said, wow, 98% of our users, we can make it perfect and give them the smallest page payload possible and make it really fast. The other 2% can get a new phone, is what they said. Or they said the other 2%, if they're clamoring about it, we're just going to add another device channel down the road and try to accommodate those users as well. So check this out. Up in the URL here, see the question mark, device channel equals? It's a query string parameter you can use to trick your browser to render a given device channel. So you don't have to send a different user agent via plugin or something like that. And you don't have to have the mobile device right there and connected to your dev environment.
We won't tell your boss that if you want to buy some, though. So,
so here we have the iPad device channel. And you can see it's different, right? I got a different menu up in the top now, which drops down and allows me to click on a different link to move around. The hero graphic's been changed, and it doesn't have the box of information on here anymore. And the way the information is organized in the bottom of the page is a little different and more suited to a tablet as well. So even though it's not a responsive design, we were able to take the same approach of giving a different user interface. Well, with device channels, you've got more flexibility than you do with responsive design. Because in responsive design, you are restricted to using that grid-based layout where things start like three things stacked in a row, and now you get smaller and two stack and one swings under. You can have a completely different look and feel without playing CSS games or dealing with those grids that you have to do in responsive design. So it allows you to have much more control over your content and make a more tailored experience to each individual device. If I pop over to the iPhone channel here, you'll see it looks really wide. Well, one of the reasons there is because you have to set viewport tags and other things inside of your device channels to say, I am targeting a specific size for this. Browsers don't interpret that well all the time. So your web browser is a good visual test to say, is everything rendering? But it's not a perfect test to say, is it going to look right on the device? That's when you really need to invest in just purchasing that equipment and testing on those devices. We have another page layout here as well, and this one is going to give me an opportunity to talk to you about the image renditions and some neat tips and tricks you can do there as a developer on how to hook them in and make it easy for your content authors to specify the appropriate image and use a rendition to serve it to each device channel. So if you check out the page here, you see we have a large graphic that stretches all the way to the top of the page. We have another graphic down here as well. And here it is in the iPad. Look at that. That image is a lot smaller, isn't it? And it's a different portion of the image. That's because it's a rendition. If I go over to the iPhone, you can see it's a little bit different shape here as well. If I was running them in an emulator, it'd be like night and day. Like one of them's this big, one's that big, and one's real big. But the browser kind of skews that display. So we also have the menu here that I talked about before. So let me show you how we implemented these things. Oh my gosh, it's a SharePoint list. You just said I could do my navigation in the Terms Store. Why didn't you do it? Well, the reason we didn't do it in the Terms Store is our client said to us, hey, we don't want content authors to have permissions to anything that has to do with the service applications in SharePoint. We want to lock them down to just editing our site collections, keep our permission management easy, and leave it at that. And they didn't have the Terms Store set up either, and so they didn't really want to spend time trying to get it right, learn it, and go through all that. So we said, okay, we can do that another way. Very simple. It's a SharePoint list. And as you can see in the different columns we have in here, it's a very simple setup that allows you to build your menu and sort it and assign a link and even give it a parent so you can nest things. So the way we implemented that is in the master page assigned to the device channels for the iPad and for the iPhones, we took out the out-of-the-box top nav control that comes with SharePoint, and we just put in our own control we wrote, which used server-side code to go make a query on that list, get the items back, and then emit the HTML properly. You could do it with a content by search web part. You could do it without one. Doesn't really matter there. You could even do it in a client-side approach with REST calls or CSOM or something if you so wish to do. This is one of my favorite things that Michael and I have like brainstormed together over the last year on how to make life easy for content authors when it comes to image renditions. So here you can see all the different image renditions that we have put together in our SharePoint site. Image renditions should be defined as part of your analysis process. When you're doing your wireframes and your different viewports and saying, here's my pretty picture for desktop, here's the one for the tablet, here's the one for the phone, have your designers tell you exactly what size those images are if you plan to use renditions, because then you can take those sizes and you can create your renditions like this, and you'll know exactly what size they're supposed to be, and they'll match up perfectly to the mockups. The first time we did this, we hadn't done it before, right? So we didn't really do that exercise. Then we had to loop back to our designer and say, hey, Justin, what size were those images? We need to make sure the renditions match up. So after you have your renditions in place and you pop your page in edit mode, well, if I would use a device channel panel, which is what we do in device channels approach, device channel panel is a block of HTML which puts a control on your SharePoint page, and you tell it which device channel to render content for. So you can say, this channel panel goes on and this is the default channel. Now I'm putting this one in the HTML. This is what iPhone users will see. This one's what Android. This is what Windows Phone 8 will see. And you tie them to each individual device channel. So if that's the way you go about it, and you come to the page, and you're on the desktop channel, and now you've omitted all of your images there, how the heck are you going to edit your image for the iPad if you're on your desktop? You're going to have to hack the URL every time to force that device channel, aren't you? Every single time. Can you imagine going through a SharePoint site and every page, if you've got five device channels, to go up to the URL and change that QuerySpring parameter five times just to punch in the right image because that's all that's going to be rendered there? So we came up with a pattern that allows you to implement it so that just from your default device channel, you can edit the image renditions for every single channel at once. And here's how it works. In the top of the page, you can see here's my hero image. That's my default rendition that's being associated with this image. This is just an image control that we've put inside of SharePoint. You know, I can go up here and click change picture and browse to it and use it. Then I can click this little button right here, set the image renditions. Now, I can edit the iPad and the iPhone image renditions, but I wrap that whole thing in an edit panel. So I only see this section that allows me to edit the other two when I'm editing the page. So I'm not pushing extra page payload. It's only rendering this content and even processing it when I'm in edit mode on my page. This will speed up content authoring so much to take this type of approach. I've got a link in the resource section to a blog I did, which walks you through the entire thing, has a bunch of diagrams about it, and a full set of source code. But we want to look at some code today. So let's jump over and see what this actually looks like when we go to implement it. Here you can see the code that I've used to implement this. This is my edit mode panel. Pardon me, let me jump up top. This div here is a div that's going to get rendered when someone comes to the page and they're not in edit mode. They're just browsing to my site. This device channel panel right here, you can see, is set up with the included channels to target information and content. Anything inside there is going to go to the default channel. And there I have my rich image field set to image 6, so it's perfect every time. My content authors don't have the ability, because I set this value here, to accidentally pick the wrong image rendition. Wouldn't that be bad if you're like setting up the content on the phone, you pick the image rendition for the desktop? I mean, it would just screw the whole thing up. We do the same pattern here with the iPad and the iPhone. So that's how they're actually rendered at the top of the page there. Then we include our edit panel. And this is what appears only when I'm in edit mode on the page. Inside of it, no matter what, I'm going to show the image rendition for the default device channel. Below that, just got a little clever here. We made a div, gave it a certain ID. We made a JavaScript link that toggles the visibility of it. And then within it, here's our field controls. They're the exact same name as the ones we rendered in the device channel panels. But here, they're just allowing us to do it in the edit mode from a single channel. So that's a pretty clever pattern, isn't it, to allow you to edit from just one spot. Your content authors will really like you when you plug something like that in. The other things to point out that are pretty neat that you can do is what you can do with the content by search web part and device channels. Here, I've got content by search web part with this cool thing that's cycling around. Then, in my other ones, as I showed you, we changed the look and feel of it in each place. The nice part about content by search web part and how device channels and master pages work together is that for each device channel, you specify a master page assigned to that device channel. So by specifying the device channel that I want on a per master page basis, here's my master pages. Here's my desktop one. Notice the highlighted code. I've got a desktop CSS file. Here's the one for the iPad. I've got CSS classes for the iPad rendering. There's another for the iPhone. Because when I go to the page, it knows what device channel I'm in. It applies the appropriate master page. I've linked the appropriate CSS from the master page. It all flows through beautifully. So when I get into this code, which is my display template that actually emits that hero image that's cycling at the top, I use the same CSS class every time. I just write my HTML one time, and I change the CSS associated with that class in the desktop, iPad, and iPhone master pages. So this is a really nice approach because you only have to shell it out, kind of frame your thing out one time, and then as you add more device channels, make them, make the master page, link the right CSS, edit it, you're done. Now you just targeted another device. So those are some of the cool tips and tricks that we have figured out that, like, those are the things you're not going to find unless you work with it. And you go through that thing with content authors and they go, dude, this is not working for me. You got to find a better way. And so those are kind of the lessons learned and things like that you can take with you and build upon.
All right, let's talk about the Office 365 public websites topic a little bit here. So let's set the stage for how we're going to discuss this. Here's in one of these presentations at a SharePoint conference where someone's going to say, and all of this is available on-premise or in the cloud, and everybody's really happy. We would love to do that here. It's not quite true today. There's some limitations as compared to some of the things we just talked about. We included a link in the deck to the feature comparison on office.com that really goes in detail with matrices about what's available where and how. But let's not be negative here. The last thing I, you know, any developer ever wants to hear is that they can't do something. So, you know, let's not bum you out, and this is a dev session, so let's talk about what we can do. So what we get out of the box with the Office 365 public website is the WCM infrastructure. We talked about that before. Let's not gloss over it. That's pretty important. We get availability for WYSIWYG editing. We have our master pages and page layouts, our versioning, and our publishing controls that we always have in SharePoint. You know, when you create a public website, you get some of the default pages there. Doesn't mean you can't create your own in kind of the same way as we can on-premise. The design manager is available. I can create composed looks. I can choose my composed looks. I can edit my themes, things like that. Image renditions that we talked about a lot is there. We can deploy apps. There's some concerns there. Again, we have links to some blog posts and such that discuss that. Our SEO controls are there. Page metadata, the robots.txt file, all those important things to make search engines do what we want is all there and available. We included here, you know, hosting's included with O365. Yeah, we have some limitations in feature set, but we don't have to worry about, you know, hosting a farm for this. And, you know, custom domains are supported, right? We don't have to have a SharePoint.com URL for our public site. Mm-hmm. We can use our custom domain names.
When you talk about mobile for O365 website, yeah, it can be done. And you'll see that if you've been to whymicrosoft.com as well in the demo we're about to show you. You can do a responsive web design. Sure, that can be done. You can do device channels. This is where the difference is in the details. You only get two device channels, and you can't create your own on Office 365 currently. The first one is called the default channel. You can use that, and that is targeted toward desktop web browsers. The second one is called fallback mobile. That one includes a list that Microsoft continually updates in the Office 365 environment, and they add new devices to that channel so that when new devices are created and you browse to the site with it, as well as tons of other mobile devices they have in that channel, your mobile traffic then goes to the channel. So it's like desktop, mobile. What do I do? How do I target iPhone versus Android versus Windows Phone versus tablet? Well, that's when you use a hybrid approach, and that's what we did on the whymicrosoft.com website. The default channel serves up the information for the desktop browser. The fallback mobile channel has a responsive web design inside of it. So that's kind of crazy, isn't it? It's like I said before, choose one or the other, but really here you're choosing both. You've got a device channel to say you go here or here, and then if you land in the mobile one, now we use responsive design to tailor the experience accordingly. So you can definitely mix and match there.
So with what we get that we talked about there, what can we actually do? I think I'm too far away to use the clicker here. So like I said, publishing actually gives us a lot. We have that content management experience that's a big benefit for using SharePoint as a WCM platform. And as we'll see, we can do some more things within that publishing model, like what I like to call the snippet model. And I'm not referring to the snippet gallery itself, but for all those client-side controls that we like to put everywhere, rotating images like that hero image we saw, accordions, all those fun UI controls that we can do client-side, we have rich HTML fields, we have web part zones, and we have the script editor web part. So, if we construct our client-side code in an intelligent way, we can provide our content authors, and yeah, they have to be a little bit more sophisticated than someone who's kind of paste from Word here, but it's 2014, HTML is the thing. And so if we can provide really clear and easy to modify HTML and JavaScript little blocks that our content editors can paste into new pages, we can build a lot with that, like I said, if we construct our back end kind of properly there. And if that's not enough, there's nothing that says we can't use the rest of the cloud to help us out. And obviously there, the sky's the limit. I mean, I have a full Windows Azure. We have MVC websites we can build there. We have databases. We have all that kind of stuff. Well, the challenge in building a site there, and why you were thinking about using Office 365 in the first place, is that content management kind of sucks. Either someone has to have Visual Studio and publish things, or I have to go build something that enables people to get their content out into the cloud, and that's really no fun. But we have that in SharePoint already, and for the majority of assets, our CSS file, our scripts, our images, things like that, there's no reason we can't continue to store those in SharePoint and just refer to them in our code on our web app side. And we'll see some places where we've done that. There's also cross-domain data gathering techniques such as JSONP or some of the cross-domain libraries that are starting to become available in newer browsers. We did just want to note that when you do that, if you're controlling both sides of the code, be very careful about how you're writing things to avoid cross-site scripting attacks, request forgery attacks, things like that. I'm not going to delve deeply into that, but it's a big topic when we're doing cross-domain things.
So quickly, to build on Mike's point about the snippet model, make your HTML and JavaScript simple so content authors just have to change a couple things and they can edit it. Well, whether you're building an on-premise SharePoint site where you have field controls in your page and they're all locked down and styled and they just type in text or they go for rich HTML areas, you still write them a user guide, don't you? You tell them, okay, you want to add this type of content? Here's how you pick a page layout. Here's how you pop it in edit mode. Here's how you apply styles, etc. You're just writing a little bit different user guide in this case, and it has snippets of code in it. It says, if you're looking for an accordion control, go to the page, add the script editor web part, copy and paste this in. Here's the three different things you can change in it to do the look and feel, how many items are in it, and the wording. And they just replace it there instead. So it's just a little bit different way of thinking about it. It accomplishes the same goal. So why Microsoft.com? The challenge, this one here. So here's a screenshot of what MyMicrosoft.com used to look like when it was running in SharePoint 2010. So Mike led this project. I was on other projects at the time, and I was actually on the one we showed with the device channel project at the time, and he was working on this one. So I'm going to let Mike run with this one and tell you all the things about really how we took how Mike and the team took whymicrosoft.com from 2010 to an Office 2013 public website.
So where we came from with whymicrosoft.com was part of a suite of sites that we'd worked on for Microsoft that were all kind of built on a shared platform that Todd and some others developed over the years. It was just a SharePoint 2010 on-premises publishing site with all the familiar things that we should be used to with those master pages, layouts, pages, etc. There was quite a bit of full trust code and a few WFP solutions deployed to the farm to do some kind of gluing stuff together code that we kind of tend to do on the server side. Most of this content was delivered by a content by query web parts. We loved the content by query web part. There's still cases where we love it. In this case, it really got abused. We had a couple of devs who were just like XSLT masters and loved to write XSLT that nobody else in the world could ever read or maintain again.
It.
Yeah, including both of us. Like, whoa, dude. So it worked, but we're just about 15 custom lists and content types to support all those content by query web parts. There was absolutely no mobile experience. If you browse to the thing on an iPhone, you got a really messed up looking view of the desktop site.
Font size 0.5 or something.
at the most. So what did we get asked to do here? The first question was, OK, we've got this website. And it really spends a lot of time talking about how great the Microsoft Cloud platform is. Wouldn't it be cool if we could rebuild this thing and host it on the Microsoft Cloud platform? Oh, and by the way, we're redesigning it. We want full RWD or mobile optimization, and we're adding a lot of content. So being developers, we said, oh, sounds awesome. Let's do it.
Yeah, we can do it. We're like, I don't know.
Exactly. So let's jump over to a demo.
Two?
I think it's two. Yes, it is two. So
Mike's going to walk you through a lot of the different components and just how we found
our way. If we have any Hawks
way.
Fans there that want to comment on that, again, that's fine.
Self-promotion of the Seahawks fans right there.
So here we have why Microsoft looks like today. It's hosted in Office 365 as a public website. So we're at our homepage here. We can see that we have a rotator control, as I was talking about before, present some content. We have some general page content, some rotating through customer quotes, things like that. We have an item here that rotates through some news that actually this content is content managed and stored in a SQL Azure database via our content managers, and we're pulling that into the site. I'll show you a little bit more about how we did that. We have our footer control. It's just kind of the standard Microsoft footer, repeats our site navigation. Again, mobile view, aggressive on the clicking. Mobile view here is, as we said, this is actually a device channel. So we have a device channel that supports all of our mobile sites. It's responsive within that. We're looking at kind of the Windows Phone view of it here. All the same content is shared here, including that rotator control, headers, footers thing. So I wanted to show in specific how we did the rotator control here and actually what the edit mode of this page looks like in general. So we'll come over here, we'll pop into edit mode. Pardon my secure content warning.
Be careful not to click save.
Be careful.
This is a live site.
This is a live site. We're going live from Las Vegas, editing production sites. Thank you. It's gambling, right? We love to gamble. So none of the Why Microsoft folks are here today. We've got just some standard publishing controls here, like I say. We've got a page layout for the home page. Here's some rich content controls with an image and a link and some text that's all been inserted there. So I wanted to talk about our news rotator. So if we look at this thing, we see the edit snippet link down here. This is a script editor web part. That's all it is. So we can edit this. We see we have some HTML here. I've actually pasted it into Visual Studio just so we can look at things a little bit easier. So here's all the HTML that controls that. Pretty standard stuff. As you can see here, we've got our data binding attributes. We're using knockout.js to do a MVVM kind of pattern here. You can use any kind of pattern you want. There are none at all. I know a lot of speakers this week have been talking about angular.js. That's great. We had, KO happened to be the choice here.
How's that font size in the back? Should we bump it one? Up a little? All right.
Good, not good?
I think you can do control up or plus.
There we go.
That better? All right.
Cool. Sue. There's our HTML. JavaScript, we have some kind of utility classes here. Some of the reasons this we're here is because some of these variables get edited, like the rotation intervals, how many seconds between when we rotate things. But what we really want to show here is we call a page called load common cross-domain OData, and this is the JSONP thing I was talking about. So in this case, we have our Windows Azure website with the SQL database. We have a service there that's going to return our news for us. Whoops. Sorry about that. Touchpad issue. So we can see we're calling out to our service. We're grabbing these. We're passing in the parameters we want. Here's our load common cross-domain OData. We're not using jQuery to do the AJAX post here for various reasons. But we can see that we have our code here that's going to inject our script tag, get our JSONP. Again, security is important here. In this case, You know, we control both sides. We're definitely whitelisting what URLs are allowed to be called and checking refers and all those interesting things with JSONP. So that's an example of how we can actually take data, get it onto a public website page fairly simply there.
And notice we didn't see the object that started with SP anywhere, did we? It sure has changed a lot in the years of SharePoint, right? Now we're just all this JavaScript stuff going on. And the reason I bring it up is, are you going to get a content author who could write code in there that was spsite.openweb or something like that? No. But are you going to have people who are your content authors who are capable of HTML and JavaScript with a guide that explains it and says edit the variable, like pointed out, for instance, that controls how long that it takes to cycle? Certainly. Those people with the skill set who do that can do that.
And if we actually jump over, sorry, Todd, if we actually jump over to another page here, we'll talk about that snippet model a little bit more in a little simpler context where we're not doing any kind of data retrieval. We have this rotator control here. Again, it's very similar to the one on the home page, just different size, different content, working across our desktop and mobile views. A couple other things I wanted to show on this page where we have just, you know, generally a lot of content here. We have these comparisons that behave a little bit differently in mobile versus desktop. In desktop, we're just displaying a table. You know, mobile, we have a little JavaScript trick. And apologize for the font size there. We're in a scaled emulator here and not the best for readability there. We have our blog control. On our 2010 publishing site, we were actually using that RSS reader web part that's been around for, I don't know, a long time in SharePoint. Mm-hmm. That's gone in 2013 entirely now, so we have a solution that we developed for that as well. So some things I wanted to highlight here are this rotator control. And here is where I was talking about that snippet model, where this would be all the code that a content author would have to paste into any page where they wanted to use this banner. So across the design of the entire website, all the banners are the same size, same design functionality. So if someone wants to rotate between them, we have our library function here that does all the kind of ugly HTML stuff and jQuery stuff and animations and triggers and timers and all those kind of things that really we had to write once in our development cycle and don't have to worry about. If a content author wants to use this, all they have to do is take this piece of code, edit the slide images, and also edit the text they want to show there. And again, like we're saying, you know, it's a little more advanced than just standard text, but it really is something that most content authors, and certainly ours for this site, are able to do all the time. And here's another one where we're really not even using any code, and that's the sidebar here that we're talking about. So this case studies and videos and white papers section, that's just a rich HTML control. And we didn't really want to structure it. They use all kinds of different content in here, and they really need the flexibility to put whatever they want there. So we just defined our CSS and our HTML in a way that the classes are very simple, and we can say, if you want this block here in our user guide, which I don't have at the moment to show, sorry about that, but we show in our user guide that if you want this content, have a div with this class, put your content there. So that's how the sidebars get managed.
So in this process, what you'll find is that your developers will look at mock-ups and things, and they will figure out how to write the HTML and the styles to make that happen. Whereas sometimes your team now, the content authors may define that HTML a little bit more, the CSS, but you try to do a little bit more of that front as a dev, so you can hand that off to your senior content authors, so then they can educate the rest of the team on how to work it. So it's a little bit different of a process versus an on-premise site there as well.
And just one thing real quick about the only having two device channels available. Okay, we were all agreed on that, and our marketing folks were fine with that, and then we immediately started getting questions like, well, what if I just want to do this tweak for an iPad? All right, so we have an imperfect solution here, but it's very, you know, it's 814 lines of code. Just looking at the navigator.userAgent string in JavaScript, it's not perfect, doesn't get everything right all the time, but it does give us a way to do some kind of simple browser detection when we need to tweak things that way. So that was a little bit of a workaround for our lack of a lot of device channels there.
And then you can refer to that variable from anywhere you want because we include it in the JavaScript reference by the master page on every page. So it's just globally a variable, you know, am I mobile or not? And then you can pick the appropriate CSS classes or RWD.
And even if you don't do something like this, you have the effective device channel variable available to tell you whether you're in the default or the fallback mobile experience.
And on-prem, the effective device channel JavaScript variable, head to my blog to check it out. I've also linked it in the resource section. It's a variable that SharePoint will inject into the master page if you run a PowerShell command to turn it on, and it'll tell you which device channel you're running in so you can figure it out client-side and do things there. In this case, that's really just going to tell us, are we mobile or not, because we've only got one device channel for every mobile device.
And we're getting a little short on time here, so we'll just talk about this quickly. The resource gallery here was the thing that really heavily abused the content query web parts in the old SP2010 version of the site. So in this case, we didn't feel that a client-side solution was really sufficient to do what we needed to do here and to do it well. And we wanted to actually improve upon the old experience. So we built this as an Azure website. It's an ASP.NET MVC 4 site. Actually, 5 wasn't released when we did this. It looks exactly like our SharePoint site. But we can see up here, we're on a different host name. We're going directly to our Azure website here. But as we talked about, the images and the assets are coming from our SharePoint site. So all our content authors have to do when they use our management interface that we built for this is just paste a link to their SharePoint-managed images when they add new resources.
So that's really nice, isn't it, right? Because who wants to manage files on an Azure website? Do you get versioning? Do you get check-in, check-out approval, any of that kind of thing? No. It's much more difficult to do that. So this way, you still get the goodness of SharePoint for your CMS, and then you're just hooking that in and using it from your Azure site.
And so the super advanced method necessary to match our HTML between our MVC website layout and our master page was basically to copy and paste and strip the SharePoint stuff out of the master page and then call it a CSHTML file and add a little bit of the MVC markup that helps us bundle files together and everything. The rest of the HTML here is like 98% identical between the two sites.
So as you can see, there's a lot of things you can do right inside of the O365 site, and then you can completely jump outside of it and hook that whole thing up and do the pieces of your site that require a little bit more than what is currently available for you in O365. One thing we always like to keep in mind is just look at the history of SharePoint. In SharePoint 2003, it moved to .NET. In 2007, it was still on .NET, and it grew like 5 times in what it can do. In 2010, they bolted on even more stuff. In 2013, there's even more. So if you look at this site as a V2, which is what it was, right, because we went SharePoint Online, then O365, this public website's a V2. And so the history of SharePoint says V3 is when it goes huge. So I don't work for Microsoft. I don't know what their plans are there, but if I just look at the history, I'm willing to bet some of these things we're talking about as a workaround right now are just going to be part of the product going forward. You got it there. Okay, so a couple things to keep in mind, no matter which version that you use, and then we're going to hop over to one more really cool demo. Don't forget to plan for all these things. They're going to pop up in your site. Logging strategy. Very important for an internet-facing website. You've got to be writing things to your ULS log or somewhere else so you can quickly get to a problem and log additional information beyond what you just get with SharePoint out of the box. We use this on the giant website we talked about to log things like we are about to call a service. And then the service logs into ULS as well. And the service says, I have been called. I'm about to call another service or make a query. My query is now complete. I'm now processing the data to send it back to the client. I've processed it. I sent it back. If you go to that level to get that granular and you have like triple hops going on from your front edge to your back edge system, it allows you to very, very quickly say exactly where something broke and get in and troubleshoot it very quickly. Usage metrics, don't forget to do them. SharePoint's usage metrics right now are really, they're not huge capabilities, right? They tell you some things about how your site is using, but they usually don't go to the level of when someone brings this requirement up and says, I want to follow a path through the site or this or that. Think about how you're going to plug that in. Go to modern IE, look at standards and modernization. and really follow those best practices there, because those are going to really help you out with your experience for your mobile users especially. Search engine optimization, don't forget to plan for it. Don't launch your site before you have it optimized for search engine optimization, because if you do, then you have to go clean up the mess you created and what got indexed by all the crawler sites out there. Get it right ahead of time, and then things will look perfect right off the bat in the various things like Bing and Google that crawl your site. And then page load time. Go back to that slide we talked about before. Look at all those things that are just simple, very easy web best practices to do to minimize your page payload and make it as fast as possible. So we have a cool bonus. This one only takes like 2 minutes to do to finish it off today. And this is provisioning inside of the cloud. So you can't add a site definition to an O365 tenancy. So that being the case, apps and SharePoint CSOM come to our rescue because they allow us to combine a workflow or a collaboration process that we can use to stamp out new SharePoint sites, even if they're private SharePoint sites or public ones. There is a full sample suite we had coming soon to MSDN. We found out on Monday it's on MSDN. We helped work on this with the MSDN team. We're very privileged and had fun time to do that. It illustrates this pattern and this code sample, as well as like 8 other patterns of how you can provision things programmatically to your SharePoint site.
All righty, so I'm not going to show code. It's 99% the same thing as what's on the solution pack for branding that's out there that Todd just mentioned, so go download that. I had to do a couple little tweaks to make it work. With public sites, wasn't, speaking of gambling, we weren't sure it was going to work until last night. Hopefully got it to work.
And we're going to put the code in the Yammer group for you too, though, so
right.
It's all there.
Absolutely. So I have my new, brand new provisioned public website here. This is what they look like out of the box. I don't know if everybody's seen them. We have our nice cloud graphic here, but what we really want to do is apply our client's branding that was developed by a dev team that they either had internally or that they hired. So they delivered us a package with some design assets into it. We need to break that package open, upload it to our public site, and apply it. So we have an app here. This is running on a developer site inside the same tenancy as my public site. I've given it full control to the tenant, something you probably shouldn't do, but for demo purposes, that's what it needs to go provision the site and then get an app-only context to go mess with that site after it's provisioned it. So we are going to click.
Michael, real quick before you do that, just set a little more context. You mentioned that design team gave us a design package that we're gonna crack open, put on this site, and then apply it. Where would they make that design package at?
There's various ways they can do it. They can do it in Visual Studio, like they did a traditional on-prem solution where they custom, you know, added some stuff. What we really do is we look at file types when we break those packages open and apply them effectively. Or they could use a design manager in an on-premise publishing site, and we take the assets that we're able to use on a public site and apply those.
So that's pretty neat, because basically that means you can go to the design manager in a web browser in an on-premise site, mess around with your colors and your layout and your other things, click the button to make the package, upload it here, and then run this app and watch what happens.
All right, branding completed. Moment of truth, we'll head back to my website, we'll F5 it, and there we go. Branded with a client.
We talked about this in our session earlier today where we use the same pattern to actually create sub-sites within a private Office 365 site collection. And one of the things I mentioned there was the reason this is so nice is because now I don't have to come here and upload a master page, a page layout, CSS, JS, images, everything. It's all packaged in that one thing. We push that package out, the code that you'll have available goes through the package, cracks it open, finds out what the assets are, organizes them, uses the SharePoint object model, punches them exactly where they need to go to SharePoint, and applies the changes. What you can do is sign up for 2 tenancies for your SharePoint environment, or you could use a free trial to do your test one. Essentially, when you've got the package to the point where you see that it's working well here, and you do it in one tenancy, now you can take that exact same package in an app like this, go to your production tenancy, hit the button, and you know everything is going to be perfect just like it was in dev. So to wrap things up here, what'd you learn, or at least sleep through? I did see a couple sleepers. It's almost 4:30 right now on Wednesday. There's differences between on-prem SharePoint and O365. Just because there are big differences doesn't mean you can't make a viable O365 public website, right? I mean, whymicrosoft.com is a really good example of a polished website that is really in production with a lot of content. A lot of users use it. Your key to being successful is really understanding the differences associated with those two environments and the possible workarounds there. Hopefully, we've showed you a lot of those things today and really helped you understand some patterns you can use to work around things like there is no content by search web part right now and an O365 site. And as we mentioned before, whymicrosoft.com is a good example to go look at and get some inspiration from. We have a lot of resource slides here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We did our homework, not just going to Bing and saying, give us the first thing that says O365 public website, but we really took the links, especially the things Michael and the team worked on to build that site out, to try to really direct you, as well as articles we've written, to all these topics, whether they're on-prem or O365. So we both like to say thanks for coming to our session today. We hope you learned a lot. Have a good time.